morning is Bauer against Shepard. Mr. Neely.
May it please the Court, my name is Josiah Neely, and I represent the appellants, Tory Bauer, David Certo, and Indiana Right to Life. 16 years ago, in Buckley versus Illinois, this Court struck down Illinois' Pledges and Promises Clause under the First Amendment. And this Court's decision in Buckley was reinforced 7 years ago by the Supreme Court in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, which held that judicial candidates have the right to announce their views on disputed legal and political issues. And today, this Court is considering the constitutionality of Indiana's Pledges and Promises Clause, which is substantially similar to the Pledges and Promises Clause in Buckley, as well as...
Substantially similar. The thing that most concerns me about the argument that they're similar is that the Indiana clause doesn't say don't make promises, commitments, pledges. It says don't make those that are inconsistent with impartiality in office. And normally one doesn't think that a judge surrenders impartiality by making public statements about issues of public policy. Think of me. I've written extensively about antitrust and securities, and I sit on antitrust and securities cases all the time. So what's wrong with a clause that says, talk all you want, but just don't step over the line of jeopardizing your impartiality?
Right. There's a slight difference between the clause as it existed prior to 2009 and the new version. The old version, I believe the wording is exactly identical to what was in Buckley. It's true that in the new version, they've changed two words. It used to say you can't pledge or promise anything but the impartial performance of your duties. Now it says you can't pledge or promise that's inconsistent with the impartial performance of your duties. Right.
So we all agree, for example, that Henry Friendly, who wrote this great book on federal jurisdiction, even though federal jurisdiction is an issue in every case, didn't disqualify himself on cases involving federal jurisdiction. It didn't.
Right.
He stated forceful views about federal jurisdiction, but didn't compromise his impartiality.
Right.
So that's the core question here. Why does a clause that says, say what you want as long as you don't compromise your impartiality, prevent people from stating their views?
Well, I think there's a couple of problems. First, with the new provision, I think there's a real vagueness issue. In the old code, you know, at least you knew, read literally, what it meant. It meant you could pledge to be impartial, and that's it. You can't make any other pledges. The new code, it's not clear what the commission would say, which pledges are inconsistent with the impartial performance of the duties and which ones aren't.
I understand your vagueness argument, but what would be less vague? And impartiality is a word that's been around for 200 years, well, probably 600 years, without anybody coming up with a better phrase. Do you have a better phrase?
Yes. We believe that Pledges and Promises Clause would be constitutional if it was limited to pledges and promises of certain results in specific cases. That's, you know, in Buckley, that was the concern where the court said that, you know, only a fanatic would say that a judge should be allowed to pledge how he's going to rule in a specific case that ever comes before him. So that's the interest that the state has. That's the legitimate, the extent of the legitimate restriction.
That is one interest a state has. But suppose the judge says, without talking about any specific case, in all conflicts between the police and the citizenry, I'm going to believe the police.
Right.
Right. No mention of any specific case, but one might think that kind of statement would be inconsistent with the impartial exercise of the judge's duties.
Yeah, that would refer to a whole class of cases.
Yeah, but when I asked you what should it say, you said a specific outcome in a specific case.
Right.
And that's not that, right? So we already know that a state has a legitimate interest in a broader ground of things. I'm looking for something that would be an adequate substitute for impartiality and take account of all of those classes of things in which the state has a real interest.
Well, I wouldn't have a problem if the provision said specific case or class of cases. I think that's fine. Here, though, this provision goes beyond that, and particularly when you look at both
By the way, do you think this is more vague than the provision in the Uniform Code of Military Justice saying that a member of the armed forces cannot engage in conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman?
Right. You know, there are stricter rules when you're talking about restrictions.
Would you answer my question?
No.
All right. And you remember why, as I'm bringing up Parker against Levy,
right.
You remember why the court said that was adequate? It was because there's an adjudicatory mechanism that will add specificity over time. Now, it looks to me like Indiana has that adjudicatory mechanism that will add specificity over time. If it was good enough in Parker and Levy, why is it not good enough here?
Okay. I think that the specificity that has already been added, both by the commentary and also by Advisory Opinion 102, have already indicated that the Commission is planning on and interprets this code in an unconstitutional manner. If you recall, Advisory Opinion 102 says you have a right under White to announce your general views about legal and political issues, but you can't. It doesn't apply to specific views. So you could say a judge could say that he was tough on crime, but for the specific issues such as the ones that are involved in the questionnaire here, you know, whether a candidate thinks that the Indiana Constitution protects the right to abortion, so on. The advisory opinion indicates
so
that.
I think if a judge of the Supreme Court of Indiana were to say in a judicial opinion, I think Roe against Wade was wrongly decided, but I'm obliged to carry it out, and here's the outcome, that would be inconsistent with his impartiality, and he would from that date forward have to recuse himself in all abortion cases?
I don't believe that. The question
no,
is.
No, and I don't for a second believe that the state judiciary of Indiana believes that.
Well,
and if that statement in a judicial opinion is not inconsistent with impartiality, why would the answers to your questionnaire be?
Well, I'm just going off what the Commission has indicated through the advisory opinion.
Look. I must say, I don't give a fig what the Commission has indicated. That's like saying some federal criminal statute is unconstitutionally vague because a criminal prosecutor has brought silly charges. We need to know how they get adjudicated before we can say that the statute is vague or unconstitutional. The Commission is just the body that's out there bringing charges.
Right, but the threat of enforcement does create a chill of political speech.
Look, we're back to Parker against Levy. The Supreme Court thought that what would happen was that courts-martial would be brought against people. That is, the prosecutor would bring these charges, mm-hmm. and then they'd get adjudicated, and the process of adjudication would pin down the meaning of the phrase.
Right.
You now seem to be saying that the statute is unconstitutional if anybody will ever prosecute.
Well,
no matter what happens in the adjudication phase.
Right. I think that one thing that makes First Amendment challenges, particularly involving core political speech, different from other sorts of challenges is that you are allowed to bring a pre-enforcement challenge based on chill. Usually you can't do that.
Not much under the Supreme Court's current jurisprudence.
Well, White was a pre-enforcement case. The Eighth Circuit and White II.
No, this is why I referred to the Supreme Court's current jurisprudence. You're aware, surely, of what's happened to McCain-Feingold. It got sustained against a facial challenge, and then critical portions of it have been held unconstitutional as applied.
Right.
The justices are telling us, seems to me, in very strong terms, to lay off the facial adjudication and see what happens.
I'm not sure that that's the way I would read McConnell. I certainly know that in the Citizens United case, the court has indicated that it's revisiting whether those provisions are facially unconstitutional. I don't know if that answers your question or not. Another thing I just wanted to mention about the official commentary to the code. The official commentary both in comment 15 and in comment 17 are relevant here. Comment 17 specifically addresses the issue of questionnaires and said that answers to questionnaires may violate the canon. And in comment 15, it says that can violate the canon not only for real pledges and promises, but based on what a reasonable person might believe that the judge was doing if he was intending to pledge or promise a specific result. So that, I think, makes the clause overbroad, and it also adds to the vagueness. And in the opinion, you know, the commission said that I understand it's just the commission, but they said that you would need, you know, that this would require ad hoc analysis. And the district judge in the first case, the first Shepherd case, he said that the clause would require ad hoc analysis and that it was vague for that reason. Similarly, with the recusal provision, the new provision has simply taken the language of the old Pledges and Promises Clause, specifically that you're prohibited from appearing to commit yourself, moved it over to recusal, but the same problems of vagueness and need for ad hoc adjudication exist there as existed in the prior Pledges and Promises Clause.
But isn't recusal really the kind of a catch-all, because each judge has to do some self-examination and then know when and when not to participate? It seems to me that isn't as confining. It's more confining to each person.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. Recusal is a broader category. However, we are talking here about not a judge's self-examination. A judge can always recuse himself if he thinks for whatever reason that he can't be impartial in a case. This, however, is a mandatory recusal provision, and it's a mandatory recusal provision that's based on core political speech. The Supreme Court in White said that you could have a recusal provision that went beyond, you know, the minimum of due process, and that's perfectly true, because most issues involving recusal don't implicate core political speech, right? If a person owns stock in a company, that doesn't implicate core political speech. However, what makes this specific recusal provision different is that it's requiring recusal specifically because a judge has made a statement, and even beyond that, because of how the statement might be interpreted by someone else. So that serves to make it overbroad and vague.
But that would happen any time somebody's, unfortunately, for federal appointments, they always go back to what somebody said before you get there, because they only get one shot at it. You don't have
options.
And lots of things are brought up about what people wrote, what they did when they were in the legislature, or what kind of cases they tried when they were a lawyer. So I guess,
and it's
whatever what somebody else says.
It's perfect.
Pardon me.
I'm sorry.
I said they didn't stop there. That's what you have to reflect on what somebody said before you look into recusal. Before it's an automatic, isn't it?
Well, in the federal courts, you know, the Supreme Court at least. Recusal is determined by the judge himself, so there's not a similar provision to this.
When would be a case of mandatory recusal?
I'm sorry.
Than the obvious of, you know, owning stock and that stuff, the kind you're talking about, where
right.
Subjective stuff.
Right. So as with the pledges and promises, you know, we believe that if a judge makes a pledge or promise of a specific result in a case or a class of cases, that warrants mandatory recusal, because there is a due process issue there.
And you think that's wrong? That somebody makes a pledge and say, I'm going to make sure this happens or something when I get elected? Is that the kind of pledge or promise?
Yeah, I think it's perfectly appropriate to prohibit that kind of pledge or
okay.
promise.
Yes.
Unless there are any other questions on this, I'll move on to the next provision. All right. The next provision involved is a ban on partisan activities. Specifically, Judge Serta wants to be able to participate in the Indiana model legislature and be a delegate in the state party. There are a couple points I just want to make on this. One is that in their brief, the appellees say that they're not alleging...
As you know, I'm sure federal judges have been subject to that rule for many, many years. You think the federal rule is unconstitutional,
well,
too?
I think that would be a more difficult case for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that, Justice Scalia noted this in White, that unlike federal judges, state judges have a common law-making role. They don't just apply the law, they also...
I hate to tell you, but despite Erie Railroad, federal judges have a large common law-making role.
Well, that...
You've encountered ERISA or labor law or some of the other areas where federal judges just make up common law, antitrust, too. It's not exactly a distinction.
Well, oh, okay.
State judges are elected.
Yeah, the other point that I'd made is
the difference
that judges
have
are
elections.
Right,
partisan.
Right. And I believe it was Justice Marshall in the Rainey case who said that, and Justice O'Connor also indicated this in her concurrence in White, that if a state is going to opt for judicial elections as a method of judicial selection, then they're going to have to they can't then use that as a basis for restricting judges' First Amendment rights. So there is a distinction between elected judges at the state level and federal judges.
But isn't that when you're talking about the partisan stuff? There seems to be some internal conflict because some things they can do and some things they can't do, and that confuses me a bit.
That's correct. It seems, I mean, there's an element of arbitrariness, I would say, to it, and that the judge can, for example, attend party dinners, but he can't attend, make speeches on behalf of the party, and he can endorse certain candidates, but not the platform, or, you know, back and forth. So in a lot of cases, I think that these are formal distinctions without a difference. Functionally, they're the same, and for that reason, the clause would be... not narrowly tailored, it would be under-inclusive of any impartiality
interest.
What
about speaking to groups? I noticed that they refer to the Sierra Club and the...
Yeah, that's right. That's another issue is, there are plenty of political groups that advocate for political issues but are not political parties that aren't restricted. A judge is not restricted in dealing with them in the same way that he is with a political party. And in the Eighth Circuit's White 2 decision, that was one of they dealt with a similar clause there, and that was one of the grounds on which they said it was unconstitutional, because they said that, you know, there's no interest in prohibiting the judge from doing one and not the other.
So that's just what.
Under-inclusive. Right.
But it allows certain things that could be easily labeled partisan.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Such as attending party functions, dinners, etc. And I think at the root of this clause is a kind of a double fiction. The first fiction is that if you have this provision, then judges won't have political beliefs. Now, obviously, when a judge is deciding a case, we want the judge to be impartial. We want the judge to follow the law. We don't want the judge's political beliefs to rule the case instead of the law. But it's just a fact that judges are human beings. They have political beliefs. Many times they have a history of political activity, even partisan activity, that doesn't go away just because of this provision. The other fiction is the idea that the public.
I'm still not sure where that leads you. does it follow from that argument that Hugo Black, a highly partisan senator who is appointed to the Supreme Court, after he goes on the Supreme Court, has a right to stump for President Roosevelt's reelection?
Well, I think that gets us back to the difference between federal judges and state judges. Before, is that state judges are elected, federal judges are appointed.
Was not going to be reelected, but he had an interest in having his policies carried out, in having other positions on the Supreme Court filled by people who thought like he did. Because otherwise, the four horsemen were going to remain in charge.
Right.
So he says, I've got this vital interest that the law be carried out by people who think like me. In order to do that, Roosevelt's got to be reelected. You don't want Wilkie or somebody like that in the presidency.
Right.
And therefore, I have a constitutional right to attend the Democratic National Convention, make a speech in favor of Roosevelt's reelection, and then go out on the hustings. That just doesn't seem to me real plausible.
That he would have a right to do that, or that there's a distinction here?
It doesn't seem to me that real plausible he had a constitutional right to do that.
Okay, well, I would just go back then to the distinction that I made earlier between the different roles that judges have in the state system versus the federal system. I am eating into my rebuttal time, so I just want to briefly touch
on solicitation.
Yeah, briefly touch on solicitation. Again, I did want to point out that the interest that the state invokes here is not impartiality, but basically the fact that people who are on the receiving end of solicitations might feel pressured to contribute. I would only note that that's something that applies not just to judges, but to legislatures, presidential candidates across the board, and no court, no federal court has ever held that's a sufficient basis for restricting First Amendment speech. And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Neely. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to start with the recusal discussion, if I may, and then move on to the other canons. First of all, I think it's important to bear in mind that the idea that recusal can depend on what a reasonable person might have perceived to be a pledge or a promise or a commitment is necessary in order to prevent, of course, judges just personally denying subjective intent to pledge or promise a result in a case. So it's not that unusual in the law to, for example, if we're talking about at the extreme criminal restrictions on intimidation and harassment, to think about what a reasonable person would have perceived from a comment. And this is not quite that, but it is, I think, that's a relevant analogy for purposes of making judges think about what it is that they've said, what a reasonable person might understand, and therefore what the public might understand their position to be. Are they in a position to remain impartial, or have they made a pledge that they now feel like they can't go back on because they were elected on that basis? The partisan activities canon, and I don't mean to move on too quickly if there are questions on recusal, but the partisan activities canon also,
You think Ruth Ginsburg is disqualified in abortion cases because before she went on the bench, she was not only a firm supporter of Roe against Wade, but at her hearings for the Supreme Court, she said she viewed Roe against Wade as established law and not subject to reexamination. You think that disqualifies her from ruling in abortion cases?
No, because I think at that point she was saying, in her opinion, at that moment,
then
her position.
Then I don't understand why there is a real dispute between Indiana and the plaintiffs here, because if Justice Ginsburg can say that at her confirmation hearings, why can't an Indiana judge say the very same thing in response to the plaintiff's questionnaire? Or the opposite, of course. If Byron White were asked that question, he would say Roe against Wade was wrongly decided. Right?
Your Honor, I think we view this very similarly, because we don't think that there really is a dispute here. We had a lawsuit that was predicated on an enforcement that's never happened. It's never been the case that anyone has looked at a judge, that anybody at the commission has looked at a judge who answered this questionnaire and said, aha, we've got you. You made a pledge or a promise or a commitment. And, in fact, the first time this case came up
here. Why are we here? When this complaint is filed, why doesn't the State Commission file a response saying, answers to these questions either way don't violate the Indiana Code. We don't have a controversy here.
I think in part because we don't want to invite continuing challenges forcing state officials to take positions in federal court only to avoid federal lawsuits. I think it goes back to the Lawson v. Hill notion that federal courts are not forums to put state officials on the spot.
Do you want to issue an advisory opinion to reduce the amount of litigation you face in the future? Is that it?
No, not at all. Our preference is for the court to say that there is no rightness here. There is no Article III jurisdiction over pledges and promises.
Well, rightness is not the way I would put it. I mean, the rule is established. It's going to be applied. And the problem, if there is a problem, is not so much rightness, but that the plaintiffs aren't injured.
Okay. I think it's all part of the same question on a time continuum. Either way, there's been no credible threat of enforcement based on these questionnaires. And
it's chilling. It's a deterrent, sort of, that at least that I thought that they were concerned
right.
about. Reluctance to fill out a form because they may get dinged for it, fined or something.
Right. And there's some risk of that unless you did what I suggested, which is to say, we've looked at this questionnaire. We don't think the answers to this questionnaire are any more disqualifying of judges than the answers Justice Ginsburg gave in her confirmation hearing. If you said that, this case goes away. But you haven't said that, and that was my initial question. Why haven't you said that if that's what you actually believe?
Well, I think
your clients.
Right, my clients. I think there are a couple of reasons, one of which is the institutional concern about not having feet put to the fire through a federal court lawsuit. The second interest is because there may be circumstances where somebody writes something extra on the questionnaire and that makes it a pledge or a promise or a commitment that does subject them to enforcement, or there is another questionnaire that has slightly different wording that gets into a different area. The Commission is very concerned about not giving away everything just because there's a federal court lawsuit filed. Now, I think the first go-around of this lawsuit, the court acknowledged that there was no credible threat of enforcement, in part because of the Commission's reaction to the decision in White. When White came out, the Commission was forthright, issued a preliminary advisory opinion, and said, we know that we have been looking at the prior canon, the prior pledges canon, in a way that would not pass muster under White. We're going to change our ways. We acknowledge that the judges and judicial candidates have a right to state their positions on disputed issues, but you have to be careful because you're judges. You must approach these things very carefully and very thoughtfully, that you don't do something that crosses the line into a pledge as to how you're going to rule in a case in the future.
But having a judge as one of the parties in this case differentiates it from the 2007 opinion.
It does, insofar as we have judges who want to answer the question and who claim to be chilled. But that was, I think, only one part of reading the prior decision.
But the reason they claim to be chilled is that your clients are being coy. And you're kind of repeating that here. It is, well, we can't see any answers to this questionnaire that would recuse any judges and therefore cause impartiality problems, but just out of caution, we're refusing to say that. And, of course, that's what gives the plaintiffs the concern that who knows if your clients win this lawsuit, who knows what cockamamie prosecution theories are going to happen next year.
Well, of course, the same could have been said in Lawson v. Hill, where the prosecutor refused to say that he would not prosecute under the flag desecration statute. He said he would take into consideration the Supreme Court precedent and enforce accordingly. And that was a case where the court said where there has been that kind of acknowledgement, you can't be in federal court only to force the state official to make a commitment that the state official does not want to make. If there's no, under the circumstances, no credible threat of enforcement, then there's no jurisdiction. It's not, either whether it's ripe or whether it's injury, you don't have the same scenario as where you have a new statute that has no constitutional decisions surrounding and you have a completely blank slate with respect to enforcement. So I think that we have a different kind of situation than the ordinary case where we're looking at a pre-enforcement challenge. There is a mechanism for getting results. There is a mechanism for not only, you know, is there an internal enforcement process, but there's an internal advisory process to go to the commission to seek advice. So
how long does that take?
Your Honor, it's not a formal process. I think oftentimes it's a phone call. Sometimes it's an email or a letter. Sometimes it's I don't have the sense that it takes terribly long, but it's not a formal structured process.
What do? Just call that attorney for the commission and say, can I go to this event or can I?
Yes, I think that's what happens a lot of times. Many times there are emails. Many times there are letters. And that oftentimes is the way these things are handled.
And then sometimes they say they can't go or they can't sign this or they can't say that.
I don't know the entire record of, but in terms of what in all circumstances the commission has done with respect to this questionnaire, excuse me, we have a record showing that the former counsel to the commission was advising those who would call in. They didn't have to answer it. She was providing support for what she thought was an interest by the judge not to answer it and sort of providing the ballast that was needed. The cover,
yeah,
exactly.
The cover.
Exactly. But in her affidavit, in this case, she says she never told a candidate that they couldn't answer and certainly never threatened enforcement under the canons if the candidate answered. So that's, you know, that is a very informal means that's available to the candidates. The two candidates who are plaintiffs in this case did not avail themselves of that process. Instead, they decided to go to federal court, in the words of one of the plaintiffs, to seek clarification. And our view is that that's not why, you know, federal courts exist.
You know, the usual advice is if what you need is more clarity, you should hire a lawyer.
Well, sure, and they did do that.
It's odd advice to give to a judge.
Well, I'm not sure where that takes us, other than, you know, the commission does have interests both in advising judges and providing clarity, but also in not, you know, itself pinning itself down to all manner of manipulation by judges who call in seeking to, you know, a prejudgment, as it were, on a particular activity that may have many unknown pieces to it that the commission doesn't know. So the commission does its best, I think, to provide guidance and clarity with an eye towards needing to maintain some ability to take into account all circumstances when enforcement decisions are made in the future.
If there were a partisan activity or something, I'd mm-hmm. because at least where I'm from, it's primaries mm-hmm. are the only deciding factor. But sometimes they can get a little bit nasty or something. But if someone is going to go to a group and the opponent is going to go, and if he's reluctant to go because of that very partisan group, whatever they're demanding, if he sends a letter and it says, can I go, and they say, no, you really shouldn't go to that group, and then he may use that against the other candidate who goes. This is my problem, and of course I have a problem with the elections anyway, because that's really what invites all of this. And there's no getting around it. The public will 2 or 3 to 1 when they have elected. So the question, I guess, is how, to what extent this partisan stuff was on, because there's a lot of, I guess it would be whether you're going to go one way or another on certain things. And I don't want to get into any specifics, because I'm not sure I know any. But I just wonder when you encounter something like, not you, but is it Ms. Babcock? Babcock, yeah. If she has to sit there and look at this and say, well, probably a good idea not to go, and yet, but I'm going to do my opponent's go. I don't know to what extent they get into that, but that's where this partisan thing just sort of bothers me. I don't see how to reconcile that with an elected judge.
Well, I think the commission is wary of being manipulated in whatever way, and they don't want to become tools of a political candidate, and that's why so much of this is informal. Let's bear in mind that in terms of the partisan activities that are at stake here, very limited, and two limits that go hand in hand. That is to say, you can't be a leader in a party, and you can't speak on behalf of the party. It doesn't mean you can't go and speak at a party event or attend a party event. It means you can't speak on behalf of the party.
But you can speak on behalf of yourself if
right.
you're a party member.
Right, right. The point is not to put judges in the position of being party bosses. And I think it's both in terms of preserving the judge's open-mindedness on the bench and the perception of that, and also of reducing the pressure on judges to become party leaders. I mean, if judges could become party leaders, who knows? We might have situations where circuit judges are the county party boss.
Well, that's, and they are elected, and they do have a lot of power.
They do have, exactly, but it's not partisan power.
Well, it's appointed power, we'll put that way.
Well, the power that judges have legitimately is over... The legitimate power that circuit judges have are over the parties in individual cases. It's not meant to be a power that exists to set a political agenda, to carry out political favors of any sort. It's a very concentrated and highly potent authority over individual cases. And the concern is if you put judges in the position of leading political parties, of making speeches on behalf of parties, which is in effect the same thing in terms of setting the party agenda, which is what one would do in a speech on behalf of a party, then you're going to have not only a general problem with the misuse of judicial authority, but a very difficult public perception problem. Because the public will then see judges as nothing more than another version of the partisans that they elect to the other offices, and they will see judges as being in the position of using the judicial office to carry out party activities. Regardless whether we elect judges on party tickets, it seems to me the state has a compelling interest to limit the partisan nature of judicial campaigns and the partisan nature of judges who are eventually elected to office. It's not inconsistent with electing them to say, well, yes, but there are limits as to what you can do. You are not the party itself. With respect to solicitation, the concern is, I think, the district court pointed out there are legitimate concerns about perceptions of bias and perceptions of...
On the solicitation and partisan activities question, I'm interested in the relation between this and the pending Wisconsin case, Siefert against Alexander. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that Indiana could prevail on these issues if this court holds the Wisconsin statutes and rules unconstitutional?
Well, I'm trying to remember the exact nature. A couple things, I think. On the solicitation side, I think we're probably living or dying with Wisconsin on that one. With respect to the political activities, in Wisconsin, there can be no party identification. And that is...
Nonpartisan election.
Exactly.
And the judge in Siefert, Siefert is the judge, wants to... join and participate in the Democratic Party politics.
Precisely. It's not an issue in Indiana. There is no problem with party identification. It's a very limited nature of the restriction that's at stake in this case. Now, it seems to me there was one more aspect to Siefert that I'm drawing a blank on at the moment that may have an impact here, but I'm not sure whether it's on all fours. But certainly on the solicitation side, I don't think there's much daylight between the two cases. But the main concern here, I think, on solicitation is that we don't want judges, again, misusing power, whether intentionally or not, to twist arms to get campaign donations. And the notion is that, again, it's a very concentrated but highly potent kind of authority that judges have over individuals. I don't think that all individuals, whether they're lawyers or not, always fully appreciate the limits on judicial power, what they understand. As I think Judge Serto in this case acknowledged in his deposition, what they understand is that judges are very important people entitled to a great deal of respect and deference. That has a potential to carry over to, even if unintentional, a misuse of authority to coerce donations. And the state has a compelling interest in not letting that happen, particularly when there are other avenues for donations to come in, such as through committees, through other people representing the judge, and so forth.
Well, is there any limit on who can head up a committee? For instance, can a brother or a spouse head up a committee?
I don't know of any restriction on that would be inconsistent with that. But I think there's a notion that the judge, him or herself, has a special impact on a potential donor that anybody else, no matter how closely connected to the judge or the candidate, would not have.
So the judge may have really people they see all the time, Kiwanis or something, and are just maybe they're at that point a lawyer. they see lawyers all the time, and they know that they're running. They come up, somebody talk, how's the campaign going? Well, fine. But if you want to talk about money, you got to talk to my brother. I don't know how you get around this, frankly.
Well, I think so particularly with lawyers, and certainly those who would appear in the court. I mean, I think there's a tremendous issue with respect to whether the lawyer, whether it's a friend or not, is going to think that they're being shaken down, that there is an arm-twisting function. I mean, in the personal approach, which Judge Serto acknowledged is more potent than even just a letter coming through the mail, is only heightened when the person asking is either a judge, sitting judge, or a candidate wanting to be a judge. I think there's a reluctance, especially if it's a lawyer who might end up in front of that judge, personally to say no. And the concern is that there's a misuse of judicial power, again, whether intentionally or not, when that happens. Now, if there are individuals, whether it's Judge Serto's wife or mother or uncles that he talked about that he wants to solicit, if there are individuals where maybe for particular reasons we wouldn't worry about coercion, that's not enough to invalidate the statute. You look at the federal campaign donation limits, and the Supreme Court in Buckley v. Valeo said, even if it's coming from a spouse or someone that you wouldn't perceive some corrupt influence, you don't have to justify it in every individual case. It's enough that there is a general threat of corruption from an excessive donation to limit all donations. Same principle applies here. It's enough that it's a compelling interest generally not to have judges coercing donations in person to justify applying that rule to everybody that the judge might solicit. So it's a concern that's I think hand in hand in many ways with impartiality, but certainly not limited to impartiality. Going back to the pledges canon, Mr. Neely was talking about first how specific cases, restricting pledges to rule particular ways in specific cases would be acceptable, and then allowed that pledging to it would be acceptable to restrict judges from and candidates from promising to rule in a particular way in classes of cases. And that's perfectly consistent with their position throughout the litigation and their interrogatories. They offered that up as a more narrowly tailored way to write a pledges canon. But in their depositions, both Judges Serto and candidate Bauer and also the executive director of Indiana Right to Life all acknowledged that classes of cases is ambiguous in the sense that reasonable people could differ about what it means. There is no greater specificity with respect to restricting promises on classes of cases than on restricting promises that are inconsistent with impartiality. I think it's probably the case that judges are much more familiar with the notion of impartiality, and they've thought a lot more about what that means than they've thought about what is a case or a class of case. And that goes, I think, with respect to both new candidates and judges that have been on the bench for a long time. There is not a well-developed history of what it means to have a class of case. So Indiana has tried. Indiana has looked at White. They have looked at what the ABA has been doing with the canons and is genuinely trying to have a canon that restricts judicial speech in a way that matters for due process and for impartiality without going beyond and getting into First Amendment protected areas. That effort began when White came out, when the advisory opinion came out by Meg Babcock. It continues through the most recent changes to the pledges canon in 2009 that changes it from a restriction on promising only impartial discharge of the duties to you can promise anything that's so long as it's consistent with impartiality. And so this is not a situation where you've got a commission who is trying to resist White, is trying to resist the protected sphere of judicial speech, and is trying to bring in the Trojan horse through the pledges canon to shut judges and judicial candidates down from speaking at all in their cases.
Well, if a judge were a candidate, it's a controversial issue. Indiana has a death penalty, and you have one judge that says there's, I'm opposed to the death penalty. I think that's whatever reason. And the other one says that he thinks that there are certain people who should get it. We clean jurors out. They can't have someone in there who says they're against the death penalty. They're off the jury. So is that a pledge that would be, I don't know what, big problem. Someone pledges that they're not going to, they don't believe in the death penalty, and I guess they would have to admit their.
Well, I think it's one thing
still
for
advisory recommendation by the jury, the judge. Is the judge's final decision on
right,
the death penalty.
Right. Right.
So what? I guess in the pledge, I'm trying to find one that is easy to get your hands on.
Well, I think one easy to get your hands on is if a judge says, I don't believe in the death penalty, and I will never, ever, ever vote to uphold the death penalty. That's pretty clear.
Why do you think that's easy?
Well,
Justice Brennan said that on the Supreme Court, as did Justice Marshall and Justice Douglas, and nobody thought that recused them in future death penalty cases.
And the canon draws a line between statements that come out in the course of deciding cases and statements that are made in political campaigns.
I don't understand that at all. Why is the same statement, I will never enforce the death penalty, if made by a judge in a judicial opinion, consistent with the impartial discharge of his duty in future cases, and the very same words would jeopardize his impartiality if said off the bench? It's the same statement. It's the same proclamation about how I will carry out my judicial office tomorrow.
It has to do with context. The context of the statement in the campaign is that it's made in exchange for votes. And when the case comes before the judge in the proper vehicle with litigants, with facts, with all the circumstances, the judge is going to feel reluctant to go against a campaign pledge. If a judge has already taken a position in the proper context where the case has come before the judge, then that's the decision the judge has made.
Stranger and stranger. It now sounds like you believe that a judge who first says something in a judicial opinion and then repeats it in the campaign to be retained is fine, but a judge who first says something on the campaign and then repeats it in a judicial opinion is not fine?
I think if a judge says something in an opinion and then during the campaign, it is different for the judge to promise something during a campaign, even if it's in relation to a prior decision, than it is to put it in a judicial opinion. Now, as artificial as that may seem, I think
says in his judicial opinion, I agree with Justice Brennan, the death penalty always violates the Eighth Amendment, and the plaintiffs send him a questionnaire when he's up for retention saying, have you changed your mind on that question? And the judge says, either yes or no. You think there would be something wrong with answering either yes or no to have you changed your mind on that question?
I don't think that I changed your mind. I think the specific words are very important here. Now, if the judge is expressing things in a way that conveys closed-mindedness, that rather than a more vague, no, I haven't changed my mind, that could be a problem.
If the judge says, my mind is wired in such a way that it never changes, once I've taken a position, any contrary evidence bounces off my eardrums, never enters my head. No judge says that, right? The question, have you changed your mind? The judge is going to say yes or no. And then the judge might follow up by saying, I still believe capital punishment to be unconstitutional. I still agree with Justice Brennan. I can't fathom how that's going to imperil his impartiality if he says the very same thing in a judicial opinion and there's no problem. And, of course, what you're now saying is something that gives color to the plaintiff's arguments. You didn't need to help the plaintiffs out, but you sure have.
Well, no, I don't think I have, and I think that the answer is that there's a difference between saying something in a context of a case and saying it out on the political hustings. Now, we expect judges to take positions in cases, and we expect them to maintain some level of principled decision-making going forward. That doesn't mean we expect them to go out and make those statements in exchange for votes. Now, it may be that the commission...
That's just what I don't understand. What the rule says, what the canon says, is you can't say to voters something that imperils your impartiality. And if a judge goes out and says, I believe that in antitrust litigation, market power is essential in order to show a violation of the rule of reason, the same kind of thing a judge might say on the bench or in a scholarly article, why, if said during a campaign, would that jeopardize his impartiality?
Because it's said in exchange for votes.
What you're saying now has no purchase whatsoever in the text of the rule. And if this is the commission's position, it seems to me you're explaining why the plaintiffs have a genuine fear that something weird is going to happen to them if they give honest answers to the questionnaire.
I'm trying to figure out how I can be any clearer about this.
Oh, you're clear, all right. It's just that you've really helped your adversary.
I don't think I have. I think, you know, the state's got a compelling interest in preventing candidates from saying, I believe X and will never change my mind, and that they do it in exchange for votes, as the court acknowledged, this court acknowledged in Buckley as
now,
the Supreme Court.
None of my hypotheticals did the judge say, I will never change my mind.
Okay, well, that's. I thought that's what you were saying. I mean,
no.
That's...
in my hypothetical, the judge says, I agree... present tense,
yes,
with Justice Brennan, that capital punishment is unconstitutional. You're the one who seems to be reading into it, I will never change my mind.
Well, I thought you were saying that the judge was saying, I will never change my mind. Now, if that's
well,
not
the
case...
The judge can still have that position,
yeah,
but enforce capital punishment.
Yes, yes.
So, I don't see where the problem is.
How about if a judge were to say...
I will never, ever suppress evidence in a criminal case. I'll never find a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
That sounds never. Like a problem.
That is a problem, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a problem whether he says it on the campaign or in an opinion. A judge who says that in an opinion has probably disqualified himself in all future Fourth Amendment cases.
We have
said, my plan is not to follow the law.
If the question is there any daylight between statements and opinions that would disqualify a judge in all future cases and pledges that might be made on the campaign trail that would run afoul of this rule, I admit I haven't thought through that completely thoroughly. But I think we may be missing each other. I thought the hypothetical was the judge says, I will never do anything except what I'm saying now. I will never reconsider this. I will never have an open mind. If the judge is not foreclosing that, then there is no problem. Yeah, I apologize if I misunderstood the hypothetical, but that's what I thought you were saying. Okay. That's all I have if there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Neely?
Just a couple of things.
Before we get to your couple of things, before I forget it, let me ask you the reverse of the question I asked to Mr. Fisher. If this court holds that the Wisconsin solicitation and campaign rules are constitutional, is there any way that the Indiana rules could be unconstitutional?
Right. I think that I would agree with Mr. Fisher about the solicitation clause. They're either identical in wording or very close, so I don't see an issue there. The third provision that you can remember was an endorsement clause.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to that, I do think that even if the court were to say you can prohibit endorsement, that's constitutional, that wouldn't necessarily rule out finding that this partisan activities clause is still unconstitutional. White 2, the Eighth Circuit, struck down a provision that's similar to the partisan activities clause here, and just recently... there was a challenge that case was out of Minnesota. There's a more recent challenge to their endorsement clause, and the court said, irrespective, you know, there are two different provisions, endorsement's okay, partisan activities is not okay. So I would say that there was a distinction there.
Thank you.
One point that I wanted to raise based on your earlier comments about injury, my understanding is your concern is even if the commission decides to enforce the canon in an unconstitutional manner, that's no guarantee that discipline is ever actually going to be imposed because the ultimate arbitrator wouldn't necessarily go along with that. I would just say that, you know, in some cases the process is the punishment, particularly if we're talking about in the context of a judicial campaign where the commission in the last days before the campaign brings charges against a candidate saying, oh, you made statements X, Y, and Z, you violated the canon, that I think there's a real issue there. I also, on the subject of solicitation, you know, I just don't think. I would agree that if a judicial candidate, someone who's running for a circuit court, asks you for money, there's certainly a feeling, there's more of a feeling that you want to contribute than if it's a letter or whatever. But I don't agree that there's a difference between that and a legislative candidate or a presidential candidate who comes to a party who knows that the candidate is going to have the opportunity to regulate him or his industry, tax him, maybe regulate or tax him out of existence. In the case of a judge, it's not up to the judge whether he gets a case regarding the party or not. In the case of a legislature can introduce whatever bill he wants, and he can vote on any bill that comes up for a vote. So I don't see that there's a fundamental distinction between the two of them there.
Between a judge and a legislator?
In terms of the feeling
for money?
Right. In terms of the feeling, the feeling of pressure when someone asks you for money. If it's a circuit judge versus President Obama, I don't think that there's a fundamental distinction.
No, of course, no legislator ever claimed to be impartial.
No, that's true. But the interest that they're alleging here is not impartiality. It's the interest in potential solicitees not feeling pressured. In terms of impartiality.
So you must think that the rules applicable to federal judges on that question are unconstitutional. You know, I'm prohibited, even though I'm still a part-time member of the law faculty at the University of Chicago. I'm prohibited under federal rules from, say, donating a copy of one of my books to a charity auction conducted by the law school on the ground that that's an involvement in fundraising.
Right.
Because it might be that some law student and future practitioner would feel, compelled to bid up the price of this monograph on corporate law.
Right.
One might think that was
an absurd, a very healthy contribution.
An absurdly overbroad rule, but there it is. You think it's unconstitutional? I'd be happy to be rid of it.
Yeah, well, I guess I would just say that, Indiana has a separate prohibition on solicitations that don't have to do with the political campaign. We haven't challenged that. That's not an issue here. Maybe there's an issue there, maybe not. But there is a difference in that, this involves core political speech, whereas in these other cases it wouldn't necessarily do that.
I think that monographs on corporate law are core political speech, if ever I've seen it.
Well, a charity auction to raise money for a law school, I think, would be the distinction there. Unless there are any other questions, I would urge the court to reverse the district court's opinion.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.